Well, thank you, Paul and Bonnie and Mrs. Rubble. Well, thank you, Mr. Helge, for that nice introduction. I too talked with Frank Fish. He's pretty sick. He's got a head cold, but he told us a little bit about his trip. I guess they were up at 5 in the morning, he and Donna Hall and Steve and Mrs. Fish. And they went to many, many places. And I encouraged him that he should do kind of a travelogue. Some of the places they went to in Israel would be very Sabbath appropriate. They went everywhere. And I was thinking, I've got a new name for Mr. Fish, because he was, during the Feast of Tabernacles, he was leading the church people here and there all through Israel. So I'm going to call him Moses from now on. Can you name the muscle of your body that receives more exercise and less control than any other? This muscle is capable of crushing spirits. It cuts like a razor, often like a sword. It can break bones, crushes spirits, flatters, and it boasts. What is this muscle? It is your tongue. It is the 2-ounce muscle inside your head. And it is mysteriously connected to another organ in our body. Today, what I'd like to do is discuss with you that one body part that can be used for both good and for evil, for blessing and for cursing, that is near uncontrollable and untamable. One that has caused more damage, I believe, in God's church with God's people than any other. And yet this tongue, it must be tamed. When picking a subject to speak on, let me give some advice to the speakers, those that are young, new at speaking. The advice is pick a subject where you have some experience. I have great experience when it comes to the tongue. I have had to apologize for my tongue more than I want to recall. What's interesting is I'm paid to speak to individuals and groups where I work. If I were a mute, they wouldn't need me. So whereas I'm remunerated there, and I'm not remunerated tangibly here, that's what I get paid to do. But often, way too often, it gets the better of me. I say things I wish I hadn't, things I can't believe I said, because I'm trained. I know what to say. But sometimes things come out that just shouldn't be said. But you see, it's really not my fault. It's my tongue's fault, as I'll prove to you. In a recent reading, I came across a chapter in the Bible, in the New Testament, that is wholly devoted specifically to your tongue. One chapter, and it's about all it talks about. It's a very practical book. If you'll turn with me to the book of James in chapter 3, where we will spend the vast majority of our time. James, as we know, is a very practical book. It tells us about the day-to-day application. It is not high theology. It is day-to-day living. How do we live? How do we conduct ourselves? How does the tire, when it meets the road, how is it supposed to run? That's what the book of James is about. It was written very, very early of New Testament books. Many believe it is one of the earliest. In many circles, they believe that it predates the Gospel of Mark. So it's a very early book. It is written by the brother, or we would say the half-brother, of Jesus, who I believe was the first leader of the early church. James is an interesting book. James grew up where he did in Israel, but he often soars to poetry in its beautiful reading, as he gives us this everyday, very real application. The chapter that we'll look at, chapter 3, is one of his very best, I think, in my humble opinion. And so let's begin in chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body." Now that is a very interesting verse to start this subject off. Remember that the chapters and the verses in the New Testament are not there. They were devised by man, and in many cases it seems that the breaks are where they should be, because it was a great deal of thought put into them. But it's a continuing theme. But this section is very interesting. It says, my brothers and sisters, be careful when you want to teach, because those that teach inside the church, this is a warning to all of us who speak, whether it's from the pulpit, or Bible studies, or Sabbath school classes, you who are teaching, know that we will receive a stricter judgment, because words carry meaning. People are listening to you, and therefore you have responsibility, and never ever take it idly. It is an important function. Whether you speak once before God's people or hundreds of times, he says, be careful. You receive a stricter judgment, for we all stumble in many things. He says, if anyone does not stumble in word, he's perfect. He's complete. But it's almost rhetoric to the point where we are not perfect. We do stumble. We are imperfect. That is the goal, to be perfect. But we are not. Of the word that is used here, it's used 5 times, teleos, in the New Testament. James uses it 3 times, this word stumble. The stumbling has to do with sin. So we all sin. So he says to the speakers, be careful. Watch what you say. And so today, of all days, I will watch what I'm about to say to you. He says in verse 2b, he talks about a perfect person is able to bridle the whole body. It actually means, the word bridle means to lead about with a horse, like a horse with a bit in their mouth. How many of you have ever ridden a horse? How many of those horses did not have a bridle or a bit in their mouth? Yeah, fun ride, huh? The two of you, we can talk about it after church. I did it once. I'll never do it again. There's no way to control the horse. So the bit or the bridle, in context here, he's talking about someone who can bridle their entire body. That person is no one. There was only one, in fact. And that's Jesus Christ. So there is responsibility here, and the goal is to be perfect, to bridle the whole body. And then indeed, he continues in verses 3 and 4 with the same subject, of bridles and rudders, of horses and ships. Verse 3, wherever it was here, there it is. He says, indeed, we put bits or bridles in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. And that's true. From a physics standpoint, the horse is a bit of metal in their mouth. Just a small bit of metal, or possibly hard wood. It weighs 0.1% of the horse's body weight. The ratio is unbelievable. This little teeny piece of metal controls that huge animal. You move it left, more times than not, the horse will move left. You move it right, the horse moves right. You pull it back, the horse stops. That little piece of metal. So too with a rudder on a ship. Mr. Grinnell was telling me about a cruise his family went on recently. It was apparently a holy cruise, very holy cruise. It was on a Disney cruise line. And so he was telling me about this massive ship. How many of you have ever been on a cruise? Well, half of you, three quarters of you. I've never been on I've been on a boat many, many times, but I've never been on a cruise ship. And I've seen the size of the cruise ship. The rudder or rudders are tiny compared to the size and the mass of these ships. And yet the turning of the rudder turns the ship. I got to go on a yacht once. It was during the Feast in Escondido. And we went out on Mr. McCartney's small 40-footer. And I got to steer it, and that turned the rudder. It was a little piece of wood or metal and wood, and it completely directed that huge boat. It was fascinating. And that's what James is saying here. He says this rudder or this bit, they're so small, but they're instruments of great control, and they master the ship. They master the horse. And yet he says, verse 5, he says, even so, with what was just said, the tongue is a little member, and it boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among the members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. This is pretty strong language. He's not talking about a forest fire. But we all know, especially in Southern California, especially with the winds that we had, we had 70-mile-an-hour winds in North Orange County. So in Southern California, if you've lived here for any length of time, when there's winds and they're warm, we worry about one thing, fire. And just a little spark can be blown out of complete proportion with the wind, and it can engulf a whole forest. And that's the analogy he's talking about. But he's not talking about a forest. And he's really not talking about a fire. He's talking about what our tongues do as such little instruments. He used personification here. He says the tongue, it is alive. It's almost as if it's its own member. It's so severe, its damage is linked to the spiritual issue linked to fire. It is the world, he says, of unrighteousness. In fact, he uses the word Gehenna fire. He says that's what the tongue does. The tongue causes Gehenna fire. How? How could this possibly be? Well, what does the tongue do? Just a spark can destroy a forest, as we said. And I'll quote from Andrea Heitfield in her article, Burning Ourselves from Within. She says, even with all its benefits, the tongue has power to destroy us. The words we mumble under our breath on our way out the door, the ones we spit out when a driver cuts us off, the ones we hurl when we're on the defensive, all of them can transform us into monsters. Ugly words begin in our minds, slide down our tongues, fly through the air. Ironically, they can cause the most damage where we least expect it, to ourselves. The sparks we spew sweep back toward us and actually char our own hearts. And from our scorched emotions, we release even more caustic words. It's a ferocious cycle. Years later, the charred remains of simple conversations are there, because the tongue, physiologically, is tied to another organ. It's connected to our hearts. Now, physiologically, I can't prove it, but I can prove it from the Bible, and I can prove it by results. Turn with me, if you would, keep your hand in James chapter 3, and turn with me, because these verses sound very familiar. Turn with me to Matthew 15. In Matthew 15, in your red letter Bibles, this is in red. Chapter 15, verse 11, he says, not what goes into the mouth defiles a man, but what comes out of the mouth, this defiles a man. Drop down, if you would, to verse 15. Then Peter answered and said to him, explain this parable to us. It didn't make any sense. Now, this is not about clean and unclean. If you think it is, you miss the point. In verse 15, Peter, always the first one to not understand, he says, explain it. Verse 16, Jesus said, are you all still without understanding? Do you not yet understand that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and is eliminated? But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands, that does not defile a man. He's saying the things we do externally, yeah, you may have dirty hands, but what you eat goes through you. But what you say comes from your heart and goes out your mouth. And those things people hear. So Jesus' own words relates almost exactly to James chapter 3. Turn back with me, if you would, to James 3. It is not what we eat that defiles us. Not ultimately. It's what we say. It's how we communicate. The word of a father to a child, to a mate, can last for years. In my line of work, I speak to hundreds of people every year. And some of them, many of them, I see them again year on year for a review, an account review. 50 to 60% by my count are divorced. And that's understandable. It's the society we live in. And yet, I will meet with these people year after year. Many of them I've known for 10 years, 15 years. Guess what they bring up when we meet? The divorce of a person I've never met, of things that were said that were never forgotten by the spouse. By the way, men do it as often as women do it. And I say, you know, we got to get past this. We really got to get past this because I need to help you, and it doesn't have to do with someone I've never met. But you can tell the scar that has been left. The scar that has been left, simple sentences that cut so deep like a razor or a sword. Psalms and Proverbs said that's exactly what the tongue does. It cuts like a razor, and it leaves a horrible scar, lasting scars, because words hurt. Sometimes they are very much unintentional. We will say things we don't mean, and that's understandable. And we should immediately, once we figure it out, say you're sorry, apologize. But often, sometimes we pull back the bow and we fire a flurry of arrows intending for a direct hit. We will show them. We will give them an onslaught, and those are intentional. But again, it's not the tongue's fault. It's merely the agent. It's just a 2-ounce lump of flesh. It doesn't know what it's doing. It only does what it's told to do. And it's told to do that by the heart, because it's really the heart. But then again, it's not even the heart. Because when Jesus said when it comes out of the heart, he's not talking about your heart. He's talking about things that are deep, deep inside, because it's not a physical issue. It's a mental issue. Because some of the kindest, most gentle people that we know or have known, they are kind, they are gentle, they are thoughtful. They physically have a structural defect in their heart. They have a heart condition. That's the physical side. But they are the kindest, the gentlest, the most sensitive people you can imagine. We all know them. And so the problem is indeed very deep inside, and that's where it must change. Verse 7, he continues. He's not done. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. We know from our own experience, if what James thought was taming of the animals, we've got that beat. We have Shamu, don't we? We have all kinds of marine parks and animal wildlife parks and zoos where animals are trained of every type. They're trained. They're trained to do unbelievable things. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, there we go. Lions and tigers and bears are all trained. You've seen them. And yet, it says, not the tongue. This is the book of James. He says, every type of beast and bird and reptile have been tamed, but no man can tame the tongue. It's really a play on words. His meaning is very simple. We can't tame our tongue. Man generally, and all of us in particular as individuals. No one. In fact, he says it's a deadly poison. Do you get the impression from James that indeed he feels our tongue and our words spread poison? How? The poison that it spreads is when we speak. And when it contains like a noxious, poisonous gas, like Cyclone B in World War II, or what's going on in Syria, it spreads everywhere. It is too hard to control from person to person. But it's not Cyclone B. It's not sarin nerve gas. It's doubt. It's gossip. It's negative feelings about someone or something that are spread over and over and over again. And it spreads, because we're all so very similar in so many ways. And yet there is a dichotomy. In verse 9, he says, with it, our tongue, we bless our God and Father, and with it, our tongue, we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. James says, my brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. Even in James' day, it can't happen. It is unnatural. It is unnatural for a tree to produce two completely different kinds of fruit. Not naturally. It is impossible. And yet, he says, the tongue that we have blesses God, God the Father. It curses people. Blesses God, curses people. Same tongue, same heart. He says, how can that be? How can it be the same source? He says, those that are made in the similitude of God, how could you curse them? Now, a curse, we studied this in the Bible study last Sabbath when we were going through Ecclesiastes. A curse is not, you know, that dress she has on just does not fit. Or I cannot believe those two are dating. That isn't a curse. A curse is a condemning, condemnatory, critical judgment. When it says do not judge, it's the word krino. It means you are judge, jury, and executioner. Recently, I was talking with another elder that will remain nameless for fear of recrimination. And he said, many times we're fruit inspectors. I said, fruit inspectors? What do you mean by fruit inspectors? It's an interesting concept. He said, too many of us are inspecting God's fruit. We say, they have God's spirit. This one doesn't. This one's converted. Probably never was. This one isn't. This one is. This one isn't. This one isn't. This one is. We inspect the fruit. We're not fruit inspectors. We are not fruit inspectors. James is clear. We are to produce our own fruit. We are to examine our own lives. It is reflexive. We are to work out our own salvation, not our neighbors, not our wives, not our husbands, and not our children. We're to take care of our own. And so when we don't mean to criticize, and we do, James says, don't do that. Don't condemn or curse. He uses the world and the analogies around him, but we can use them again today. A spring, a fig tree, an olive tree, they cannot produce different things. It's either fresh water or it's salt water. It can only produce one. It is an impossible, a natural act for the ocean to produce fresh water. This should not be, and refers to the negative part of our tongue. Therefore, we can conclude by reading this, we should bless because we have a choice. We can bless and praise and speak good one of another. Those of us that are older will remember a phrase by, and this is not a political remark, it is a historical reference. We will remember Ronald Reagan said of the Republican Party 30, 40 years ago. It was called the 11th commandment, and he made it popular. Many of you will remember it. Thou shalt not speak evil of a fellow Republican. Interesting, isn't it? Why? Well, forget about the political aspect, because that's not the intent. Why should you not speak evil one of another? Well, first of all, it's kind of stupid. Wouldn't it be odd if someone overheard you say, well, all the people in my church are not converted? What would you say? Then why are you going there? Stupid. But more importantly, it's wrong. It's wrong. A river cannot produce both fresh and salty water. It seems only the human heart can produce that. And so he says, by inference, to bless, to say good things, positive things. Verse 13, he here gives us some wise counsel, and he shifts gears. And in fact, he uses a word that we are studying in the Bible study through the book of Ecclesiastes. Mr. Rudace took it today. It's a study of wisdom, of right thinking, right action, wisdom, sophos. But he says, James says, there are two kinds of wisdom. Two, we can translate it, two ways of thinking. Swindoll, Chuck Swindoll, in his commentary on James, calls this section the wise, the unwise, and the otherwise. It's interesting. Verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So there are two kinds of wisdom. He says, first, there is the wisdom of meekness, humility, of thinking of others better than yourself. And we're not talking about an idle joke or a flippant remark. We all make those. I do it a lot. We're talking about putting someone else down so that you are elevated. He doesn't quite say the source of that. We'll see that in a minute. But in verse 14, he talks about the wisdom of ego and of envy, of self-seeking, and it stems from our hearts. When our tongue attacks, it is usually to lift ourselves up. We may say, she is not a very righteous person. But what are you really saying? She's not a righteous person. You're really saying, I am. When you say, he doesn't really keep God's commandments, what are you really saying? I do. They don't. These should not be done. It is wisdom of ego, of envy, of self-seeking. We can do it outside the church. We can do it at work. We can do it at school. We can do it in our families. This wisdom, he says, is from the evil one. Self-seeking is evil and represents all that God is opposed to. And again, we are not talking about idle comments that are not meant to hurt. We're talking about those things that we say that can hurt, that we have seen hurt, the hurt that has been done to many of you. You would want not that done to you, so we should not do it to others. The wisdom above, he says, is pure, and there's that word of undefiled. Undefiled. We are not defiled by what we eat. We are defiled by what we say. And so this type, he says, this wisdom, verse 17, is that from above is pure. It is peaceable, gentle, and willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits. The word there, pure or undefiled, is obvious. The word gentle is interesting. William Barclay, in his commentary, says, the man or woman is known as epikeis. It is the man who knows, or the woman who knows, when it is actually wrong to apply the strict, listen to this, it's very interesting, when it is actually wrong to apply the strict letter of the law. That person knows how to forgive when strict justice gives him a perfect right to condemn. He knows how to make allowances when not to stand upon his rights, how to temper justice with mercy. Always remembers that there are greater things in the world than rules and regulations, especially as it benefits that person. It is impossible to find an English word to translate this word and this quality. Matthew Arnold called it sweet reasonableness, and it is the ability to extend to others the kindly considerations we wish to receive ourselves. What does that make you think of? Who does that remind you of? Well, obviously it reminds us of Jesus Christ. He had every reason to call down the armies of heaven and blot out all that Rome, all that Israel had against him, unjustly accused. Instead, he practiced humility and patience. Wrongfully accused, he had justice and the law on his side, but he gave mercy, and that's the wisdom from above. So let's conclude. Aren't we all glad in this room, John is, that there is no recorder, no permanent record of our tongue, where someone can stick in a CD or an MP3 flash drive and record the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years of our comments? I am, for one, very grateful. If there were, what would it sound like? I shudder to think. I think of me because I know what I've said. Let's look at some keys in conclusion from James on the taming of the beast, the taming of the tongue. Number one, as difficult as this is for me to say, we should avoid complaining and grumbling about things that we have no control about, which are really minor and don't really affect this wonderful life that God has given us. Two, we should at all costs avoid self-aggrandizement, boasting. We should practice humility as Jesus Christ did. We should focus, as Philippians says, on the positive things. We heard that in the special music. Nothing can separate us from God. We should concentrate on the positive. We should remember, number four, what Jesus Christ said. We should do to others with our tongue which we would want done for us. How would we like to be spoken to? That's how we should speak. Worry not about yourself. Worry about your salvation, not your brother, not your sisters. Five, we should practice patience, especially as it relates to our tongue. Many of us feel that a faster response shows wit and intelligence. Often it shows stupidity and arrogance. And last, from Ecclesiastes 5, verse 2 and 3, we should talk less. Ecclesiastes says, when words are many, folly is not far behind. And on that note, I am done.